I guess I'll go ahead and begin. I've had one piece of pizza that should tide me over for the talk. I'll take the relaxed approach. I'll sit down for the first part. I'll just be talking about, George asked me to talk about differential rotation in the sun and our modeling efforts with the code, which we call it the ASH code. It stands for anelastic spherical harmonic. There's actually a lot to talk about because various people have gone off in various directions on modeling differential rotation in the sun. So this talk will be just a general overview of what we've done and where we stand. Just a lot of people are involved in this. The original ASH code was written by Tom Clooney and myself. But the algorithm goes back to Gary Glatzmeyer. It's essentially the same thing he was using 20 years ago. Since the original code, Julian Elliott, Sasha Brune, and Mark DeRosa have continued to develop the code and apply it. And mostly on the scientific end, Yuri Tumrey and Peter Gilman have remained involved in this whole effort. So today, I'll start with some brief comments about general comments about the solar rotation, and then talk about how we model it with the ASH code. We can refer to this as modeling with ASH, as MASH for short. And most of our efforts thus far have concentrated on the bulk of the convection zone, and that's probably what got me my job, so that's the most lucrative part of ASH. But that's only part of the story. As I'll show you, the solar rotation has many mysteries about it, and among them, also in the bulk of the convection zone, in addition to that, there's a shear layer just below the surface of the photosphere. And mostly Mark DeRosa has led the effort in that. And so he's been modeling the shear layer with ASH. And I've been doing a lot of stuff in the last couple of years about applying it to the tachocline. I hesitate to give that one an acronym, though, so I won't. So what does helioseismology say about the solar rotation? If you've heard any talks about the solar interior in the past decade, it's the same story, basically. We've known for centuries that the sun rotates fast at the pole and fast at the equator and slow at the poles. What we now know from helioseismology in the past couple of decades is that rotation profile imprints itself throughout the convection zone. So angular velocity contours are essentially constant on radial lines at mid-latitudes, and the profile doesn't vary much with depth. These plots over here might be a little more illuminating than this. These are angular velocity as a function of radius at several different latitudes. And you can see that in the bulk of the convection zone, it's pretty much flat throughout most of the convection zone at low and mid latitudes, a slight increase with radius. And there's a slow decrease, or a monotonic decrease, in the angular velocity as you go from the equator to the poles. And that persists throughout the entire convection zone. But something happens. At the base of the convection of envelope, all of a sudden there's a transition to almost uniform rotation. So there are a number of puzzles about this. First of all, from a modeling perspective, there are a number of challenges. First of all, you have to get the contrast and angular velocity right. It's about a 30% variation from equator to pole. And you have to account for these shear layers at the top and bottom. There's this, I guess I didn't mention that. In addition to this bottom shear layer, the tachocline, which is the transition from essentially radial angular velocity contours at mid-latitudes and a latitudinal differential rotation in the envelope, to uniform rotation, this transition layer is called the tachocline. And it appears, it's kind of ambiguous from pictures like this, but the most reliable and most recent calculations, estimations of where the Taklukkanen exists, suggests that it's mainly located below the convective envelope. So it's in a stably stratified region below the convection zone. And looking at a picture like this, I should also mention that it's pretty obvious that convection has something to do with the differential rotation in the sun. That there's this big differential rotation, and then at the base of the convection zone, suddenly there's a change. So this differential rotation has something to do with the convection. Vertical shear layers, there's a layer of vertical shear near the bottom, and near the top, at nearly all latitudes, there's a sudden change to a negative angular velocity gradient with radius. So very near the top, as you go in from the photosphere, there's a speed up of the angular velocity. And another thing that has proved to be a real challenge from a modeling perspective is that there's this monotonic decrease from the equator to the poles. And the poles are rotating very much slower than the equator. And this is a bit of a puzzle, because if you have fluid motions near the pole at high latitudes that tend to, it's the old proverbial skater pulling in their arms. As you come closer to the rotation axis, you'd expect it to spin up. And that's what the pioneering simulations by Gilman and Glatzmeyer 20 years ago of convection in spherical shells, they showed fast poles. And most of our simulations now show a tendency for the pole to spin up. But that's certainly not what the sun is doing. In fact, it's going slower than you might think. If you do some kind of expansion of the latitudinal rotation profile in terms of A plus B sine squared theta plus C sine to the fourth theta, it fits it pretty well up to high latitudes, and then the real solar rotation drops below what you might expect from a simple extrapolation. So that's a bit of a puzzle. Why are the poles going so slow?
The observations are not reliable near poles.
They're not reliable. Yeah, they're not reliable very near the pole. But they're still pretty reliable up to about 60 degrees or so. And up to about 60 degrees, it does seem to be decreasing as far as we can tell. And another remarkable thing, you have all this, as I'll say, the convection in the envelope is thought to be highly turbulent. So you have this mess of velocity structure, but it's creating this differential rotation that's extremely smooth and steady. It doesn't have to be that way. If you look at the differential rotation in the outer planets, the Jovian planets, you see banded zonal flows, and there are retrograde and prograde jets as you go in latitude. This just has a very smooth variation, and it's steady as far as we can tell. The mean differential rotation now within the error bars is the same as Carrington measured 150 years ago. There are very small variations of 1 or 2% that seem to be associated with the solar cycle, called torsional oscillations. But that's on the 98% level, it pretty much stays as it is.
I may be jumping the game here a little bit, but mm-hmm. You know, when SOHO came up, Withrow and Rolf made this big announcement about polar jet streams and so forth.
Right.
What does that fit in with this?
That's a bit different. The basic I don't know if you call it a controversy, but the basic issue there was that it's not visible from these, but there are the two instruments. There's the SOHO MDI, and there's the GONG network of instruments on the Earth's surface. And if you looked at one set of data, if you looked at the MDI data, you saw what appeared to be a submerged jet at high latitudes. So there was a prograde jet. It's not visible in these images. But if you looked at the GONG data, you didn't see it. And I don't know what the resolution of that was. I think in the end, it was just that, I don't know if it was statistically significant. As Sasha said, the helioseismic results near the poles are unreliable. So it may have just been some artifact. So we ask, where does the differential rotation come from? And it's very simple, and there's no mystery here. If you just take your basic fluid equations, your conservation of mass, and your conservation of momentum, I've just left out. I'd like to make my assumptions very explicit, and there aren't many in this. Basically, in this momentum equation, I've neglected viscous dissipation, and that in the sun, that's a good approximation. The Reynolds number in the sun, which is essentially a measure of how big the viscous term is compared to this advection term, is 10 to the 12th. So the viscous term is very small, so you can pretty much leave it out, and you expect the convection to be highly turbulent because the Reynolds number is so high. As far as Lorentz forces, since this is sort of a magnetic audience, you might object to not including Lorentz forces, but there are two arguments why you can leave them out. First of all, if you look at the average magnetic field strength in the convection zone, the magnetic energy is much less than the gas pressure of the plasma, so it probably has a little dynamical effect. In most of the convection zone, it might have an effect in isolated flux tubes, isolated regions. But the other argument for leaving it out is that if it played a crucial role in driving the differential rotation, then you might expect it to change a lot with the activity cycle, and it certainly does not. So we're going to leave out Lorentz forces. So given these equations, all you have to do is assume that it's steady state, so you can average over time derivatives, statistically steady state. It doesn't have to be a steady flow. And you come out with this. The momentum equation just implies that the gradient of a flux or divergence of a flux is zero, and that flux has an r and theta component. That flux has a component, a part due to meridional circulation and a part due to Reynolds stresses. The L here is defined as the angular momentum per unit mass. So basically what this tells you is that the meridional circulation, these angular brackets, by the way, denote averages over longitude and time. So what this tells you is that meridional circulation tends to transport angular momentum, and then Reynolds stresses, the non-axisymmetric correlations, velocity correlations.
Why dc comes as v and the other comes as momentum, rho v, r?
Oh, it's just how you want to express it. You can express it in different ways. This might be the most illuminating.
It comes naturally or assume this because it's a different thing. You work with v or you will work with momentum, rho v, and it's sort of not the same, to my understanding. I mean, you carefully separated rho vr and vt.
It comes in.
Because that's the only thing that makes sense in the convection zone.
But why
there's only one row. You could have a rho vt, but then you'd have to divide by an average row.
Oh, I can divide, yeah. Fine.
I mean, you could mix in this average. I've combined the average of v phi with the rotation rate of the coordinate system as the total angular momentum per unit mass. But you could
angle bracket of v phi is the thing that would define the differential rotation.
Right, right. This omega is the uniform rotation of the coordinate system, and this is the differential rotation. But yeah, the rho v theta, it just comes out. You have this rho out in front of the advection term. And I think you could probably manipulate this so you could combine it with the v phi if you wanted to. But this is just one way to express it, and it's a clear way to express it because this mean meridional circulation transports specific angular momentum, and you can so there's no mystery here. What determines the differential rotation in the sun is the balance of Reynolds stresses and meridional circulation, And then we could look, take a closer look at the meridional circulation term. It can be written, if you assume a steady state, so there's no mass sources or sinks, you can write the meridional circulation contribution as this. And what this implies is that the circulation, if there's no Reynolds stresses, the circulation will tend to establish streamlines or constant angular momentum along streamlines. So streamlines are coincidences with contours of constant specific angular momentum. So what that implies, if you have a circulation cell like this in the sun, say, or it doesn't matter what drives it either, and you just have this cell. And notice that on the previous page, I made no mention of thermodynamics or any equation of state effects or anything like that. It's just the momentum, conservation of momentum and mass. And what that implies is the circulation, if you have axisymmetric rings of fluid that are going around with the circulation, as they come closer to the rotation axis, they'll tend to spin up, and as they go further away, they'll tend to spin down. So what you'd get is an angular velocity that's fast at the poles and slow at the equator, which is not what the sun is doing.
So that divergence is zero, right, if there's no Reynolds stress?
Right, if there's no Reynolds stress, yeah. So rho vm dot grad l equals zero, which implies that streamlines are aligned with angular momentum contours.
Why do you know the direction that's from equator to pole?
It doesn't matter what direction it's going. It's just the argument is just that if this equals zero, then whatever streamlines you have will tend to conserve angular momentum. So as things come close to the pole, they'll spin up, and as things go away, they'll spin down. So it doesn't matter if you have one cell, you could put in two cells, you could put in, you could have it go the other way around. If you just had meridional circulation, it would give you a rotation profile that doesn't look like the sun. So again, as I said, there's no mystery here. It's Reynolds stresses in the convection. And I might also add that this L here, the specific angular momentum, is what...
What was the previous argument for? For Reynolds stresses or against?
Oh, I'm just saying that Reynolds stresses... Yeah, they must drive the convection. The circulation...
The argument is the opposite. Goes the opposite way, right? Because if it were only Reynolds stresses, then the meridional circulation term could be zero. But the argument should it cannot be zero, because in that case, the streamlines would coincide with...
Well, no, if there's Reynolds stresses, then this is not zero. So this is not true. It's all streamlines equal angular momentum contours only if there are no Reynolds stresses, in which case this is zero. If you have Reynolds stresses, which tend to produce some kind of differential rotation, the meridional circulation can counteract it. Right.
And you're assuming here that there's no divergence in the masses.
Right. No, the average of d rho dt, statistical average, is zero. And I was also going to mention that this is what helioseismology gives us, the differential rotation as a function of latitude and radius. And we don't have it yet, but we can conceivably, we have it near the surface, but as helioseismic measurements improve, and as if we get some kind of instrument, something like stereo, can get greater coverage of the solar surface and measure low degree p-mode oscillations, we can conceivably in the future get this term from helioseismology too, the meridional circulation. So if we know the axisymmetric circulation and the differential rotation, we know exactly what the meridional circulation must be doing. And by extension, we know exactly how Reynolds stresses must be redistributing angular momentum in the sun.
Let me ask you about the choice of variable. You can work with rotation, with omega. You can work with angular momentum as you choose.
Mm-hmm.
But in atmospheric science, they confuse from both, and they choose sort of potential vorticity.
Right.
And there is
that's most
a good argument in favor.
Well, potential vorticity is Potential vorticity is most relevant when you have a strongly, stably stratified system. In that case, stably stratified system. You can define potential vorticity as something like what is it? It's something like the absolute vorticity dotted with a gradient in entropy divided by rho. And in the Earth, the gradient in entropy is exclusively vertical, so that your potential vorticity is directly related to the vertical vorticity in the fluid. And under that approximation, it becomes pretty simple that everything is dominated by vertical vorticity interactions. And in the sun, this grad S term, and in the convection zone, this grad S term is almost zero. And contours of constant entropy go all over the place. So the component of vorticity that's irrelevant changes throughout the convection zone, and potential vorticity just isn't as good of a measure.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mark? Yeah.
But don't you already know a lot about what the Reynolds stress has to do? Because you know what you get without it, and you know what you see, so doesn't that tell you what the Reynolds stress has to do? Even if you don't know exactly what the meridional circulation is, you don't know its function of depth, you still know roughly what's going on.
Right. Well, that gets into the other point that I'll get into now. You don't necessarily know what the meridional circulation is going to. If there is a meridional circulation, it will tend to do this. It will tend to spin up the poles. And well, you know basically what the Reynolds stress is doing. It's spinning up the differential rotation. But what I'm saying is, if you knew this term exactly, you could calculate exactly, as a function of latitude and radius, where the Reynolds stresses are taking and depositing angular momentum.
I've got a question. I remember we have one fellow here who's interested in stars, right? So does this understanding of the differential rotation work well enough to actually predict it for other stars?
Well,
I know there's some Doppler imaging that you get to see evidence of a differential rotation in other stars.
Well, I want to be careful here. I'm saying that we know it's Reynolds stresses, but I'm not saying we understand it. somehow, rotation induces systematic velocity correlations in the convection, which produces the differential rotation. But that's where the mystery is. It's not what's causing it. It's Reynolds stresses that are causing it. But as far as understanding it well enough to predict how it depends on rotation rate and stratification and compressibility and various other things, we're not there. We're still trying to understand why. So we understand what Reynolds stresses do, but we don't understand why they do it yet. But this gets to Bob's question: what else influences the rotation profile? So if you look at the zonal momentum equation, it's only meridional circulation and Reynolds stresses. Those are the only players. But you can get more insight if you start again with this equation, same momentum equation that I listed on the other page, and again you assume steady state and you take the curl of it and you get this. And now you introduce a few more assumptions. First of all, you assume, let's say, what if the fluid vorticity is very small compared to the rotation rate of the star, so that we can neglect this compared to that.
Is that absolute vorticity or vorticity in the rotating frame?
Vorticity in the rotating frame, just del cross V, curl V. Yeah. And also, if you assume an ideal gas with constant CP and constant gamma, so that entropy is defined by this, and if you assume to a first approximation that it's hydrostatic, the mean stratification is hydrostatic, so you're neglecting a turbulent pressure due to the convection. If you make these three assumptions, you come out with this, which is the thermal wind equation. And it says basically that any variation of the V5, the zonal velocity, along lines parallel to the rotation axis is due to a latitudinal gradient in the entropy. So if you have any kind of latitudinal gradient in the entropy, and the thing is rapidly rotating, so this thing is big, you're going to get some variation along the rotation axis.
Can I see from this where the Taylor-Proudman theorem comes?
This is the Taylor-Proudman. If dsd theta is zero,
that's
del dot omega dot grad v phi is zero, and you have a rotation profile that's aligned on cylinders.
That Taylor-Proudman applied if the Rossby number was very small.
Yeah.
But it's also if the Rossby number is very small and the fluid,
what's the Taylor number?
Doesn't have any entropy gradients? Is that both of those?
Well, what you need is this term to vanish. So if it's a polytropic fluid where P is a function of rho, then it goes away. Or if it's, this is, if pressure surfaces and density surfaces coincide, then these torques go away. And also you neglect viscosity.
This is because you assume geotropic approximation by this condition.
Right, and I should say, so I just said that only meridional circulation and Reynolds stresses can possibly give you a differential rotation. Now I'm just saying that a latitudinal entropy gradient can do it. And is that consistent? And the answer is because what you just said. I assumed.
We didn't hear the second was just said.
He mentioned. I'll say it again now. This thermal wind equation assumes geostrophic and hydrostatic balance. This is the hydrostatic balance part. Geostrophic balance is that Coriolis forces balance pressure gradients. And if in that limit, in the hydrostatic geostrophic limit. There is no meridional circulation, and there is no convection. So that's how. Basically, you can think of it as this is the meridional vorticity equation, and if there is some imbalance here, if you have some latitudinal entropy gradient, it will tend to drive a meridional circulation. But if the system's rapidly rotating, that meridional circulation will immediately be diverted into a differential rotation. So in the rapidly rotating limit, there's no meridional circulation and there's just differential rotation. But the upshot is that entropy gradients can indirectly drive differential rotation.
That's like the difference between the Rossby number on the one hand and the Taylor number. Both somehow measures of the angular velocity, but the inverse Rossby number is the one which really is able to drive anisotropies in the fluid, and therefore entropy, latitude and entropy gradients.
Right. Theoretically, the Taylor number should be irrelevant in the sun, almost, because viscosity should be so small.
Okay, now if you detect the turbulence velocity, so it is still. You are doing a mean field theory, so that's why you have to do use the turbulent viscosity. And then the Taylor is not so incredibly large anymore, but it's still on the.
Well, I haven't used any mean field theory here. All I've done is average the. I mean, all I'm saying is if the Reynolds stresses go away, you have this balance. That's all I said. I haven't introduced.
Yeah.
Any.
But the case when you can neglect the Reynolds stresses is when the Taylor number is high because the ratio.
Yeah, essentially.
So here the Rossby number is the ratio of the vorticity to the large scale circulation.
Well, to the rotation of the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you do in mean field theory, the turbulent viscosity is contained in this. If you define the Taylor number in terms of a turbulent viscosity, I don't see how you'd get both a Rossby number and a Taylor number.
No, you would still have a diffusion term then, the square term.
But what I'm saying is the turbulent viscosity is contained in this. So if this is small, the turbulent viscosity must be.
It's an additional term in the equation.
But you would expand this nonlinear product del cross v cross omega in terms of a turbulent viscosity and a. Basically, you're splitting up this v cross omega term into a turbulent viscosity plus something else. But and then you're defining a Rossby number and a Taylor number. But I'm not making that distinction. I'm not introducing any kind of mean field.
Actually, asking me, you split stuff into meridional circulation and random stresses, but there is also eddies contribute to diffusion, which is Laplacian, not stresses. And where is the diffusion, right? That's your question.
Yeah. Well, that where is the diffusion? It's in this. Yeah. It's all in there. So if you.
But the telenoma that is relevant should be the one based on the Kelvin diffusion.
Well, that's just another way of saying of splitting up the Rossby number.
Well, I was just saying the telenoma and Rossby number are different measures of the angular.
In mean field theory, yeah, and not the way I presented it here.
Rossby number, if that is large, that gives you a deviation from uniform entropy in the latitudinal direction.
Right.
And then you can, and so that would violate the Taylor problem theory. But if you then, on the other hand, make the Taylor number even larger, you would win again with the Taylor problem theory.
Right. Yeah. That's just another way of saying, in my way of looking at it, it's another way of saying that if the vorticity becomes comparable to this, then you can't neglect the Reynolds stress term B cross omega, and Taylor problem is broken. So Taylor problem can be broken either by this term or by lots of vorticity.
Can I ask you maybe along this thing? Mm-hmm. What is large omega exactly?
Oh, it's just the rotation rate of the coordinate system.
Oh, so like an inner region. And the little one is
the mean rotation rate. You go into the frame, rotation,
right.
Big omega.
Yeah.
The
rotation of the sun, basically.
Yeah, you have a.
Well, it's a mean. You can take it for some mean value.
It's constant times r sine theta. It's just a uniform rotation of the coordinate system. Mean rotation of the sun, yeah. So our modeling strategy, basically, you have. We take the 3D nonlinear equations under the inelastic approximation, which I'll mention in a minute, and we look for the biggest computers we can find and model this with the basic equations with the highest resolution we can find to get into the low dissipation limit.
What do you mean big? Fastest or big?
Most. fastest, most efficient, and highest memory. Just we want lots of degrees of freedom, which defines turbulence. Shave off the upper granulation layer in the deep interior for practical reasons. And what we want to do is investigate momentum transport by Reynolds stresses, which can directly drive the differential rotation, and rotation. The influence of rotation on convection. Changes with latitude, and it can lead to a heat flux with latitude, which can in turn give you a latitudinal entropy gradient, which can in turn drive a differential rotation. So we're interested in both turbulent momentum transport and turbulent heat transport. And if we understand them, we'll understand the solar differential rotation better. So this is the ASH code, anelastic spheric harmonic. The basic way to think about the anelastic approximation is it's a compromise between Boussinesque and fully compressible. You introduce some kind of mean state, which is indicated by the hats here, mean thermodynamic state, and you expand about that. So it's linear in thermodynamic perturbations and nonlinear in velocity perturbations. And your divergence of your mass flux is, mean mass flux is assumed to be zero. This filters out acoustic waves and lets you take bigger time steps. It's a pseudospectral code, spherical harmonics and stacked Chebyshevs and radial. The poloidal toroidal decomposition of the mass flux, which ensures that it remains divergenceless. Adams, Bashforth, Crank, Nicholson, and it's made for parallel computers. It's written in Fortran 90 and MPI. It's not faster. It's accuracy, basically. Chebyshevs are very accurate. What's that?
Is that so you can resolve the Van der Leer's
Yeah, well, you could do that with a finite difference too, if you chose your grid. The original version of the code uses a stack Chebyshev, so you have the option of two Chebyshev domains. So if you have a convective envelope with a overshoot region, you can have the two meet at the overshoot region, so that you have highest resolution there. The latest version that I'm using for the Takocline, I have gone to compact finite differences for efficiency reasons, because spectral methods on parallel computers are very inefficient, because you need to know, every time you do a transform, you need to know data from every other processor. So I have gone to compact finite differences. And
that too has the same problem. Maybe outside.
You don't need to know. You just need to know it from your two nearest neighbors.
No.
Not for compact finite differences.
It's totally global. You have to invert a tri-diagonal matrix, and that makes it global.
Tri-diagonal, yeah. But in spectral methods, processor A has to get information from every other processor. Whereas in compact finite differences, it needs to get information only from the other side.
But I think the last processor, before you can do that, you have to have the information from the previous processor. In order to do that one, you have to have the information from the previous processor again. And so you can really do the last processor only once.
You mean compact finite differences, or?
Correct, compact.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a parallel tri-diagonal solver is at least as efficient or more efficient than you can reduce the communication necessary in a parallel tri-diagonal solver. By picking your algorithm right, you can have different pieces that a tree of different processors. It goes something like log n or something. Are you familiar with that? There's much less communication.
Mark,
the communication goes like log n instead of n.
I didn't get the answer to George's question. You have to pay for the use of polynomials instead of grids. So they have tendency to filter the stuff, to put certain rules there. How do you pay for the beauty of Chebyshev's polynomials?
When you use finite differences, you pay for it in loss of accuracy and in spherical shells, especially a non-uniform grid, you have to do something about the poles. Spherical harmonics are a natural way of getting uniform resolution on a sphere. In the vertical, Chebyshevs are used mainly for accuracy. They're very highly accurate in derivatives. I guess I don't. Does that answer the question? What question do you have?
If I use one or two,
you can
certainly filter a lot of radial dependence, and that worries me compared to grid, which I control. But polynomial design not by you, by Chebyshev.
Yeah.
He uses as many polynomials as he would grid points. So.
That's what I expect the answer from him,
If you look just in terms of accuracy, you need a lot less grid points or degrees of freedom in Chebyshev than you do with a finite difference scheme. So you can get away with the same accuracy by using fewer memory and fewer operations.
Typically, how many polynomials do you
need? It depends what calculation we're doing, but the biggest one's something like 193 in radius, and Lmax of 340 in some of the biggest simulations, which is 1024 by 512. So what do we want to know with these bulk of the convection zone, these deep shell calculations? The obvious thing is, can we reproduce just using this self-consistent model with just the fluid equations, plugging them in and putting a flux in from the bottom? Can we get a mean flow, differential rotation, and meridional circulation like that inferred from heliosismology? And then what should we expect the fluctuating, the non-axisymmetric flows in the sun to be like? Those are very difficult to detect on the sun, but if simulations can give some guidance, then we'd like to. In the early days of turbulence research, days of Kolmogorov, everything was assumed to be isotropic and homogeneous, and you just slapped a Fourier transform on everything, and you looked at everything in spectral space and spectra and things like that. But in the past 20 years, it's been realized that what you really want to know in real world situation are the anisotropies, the how it transports momentum and heat. And in the past 20 years, it's been realized that that's often dominated by coherent structures in the turbulence. So in the soup of stochastic fluctuations, you have structures which tend to persist for some time in space and tend to be coherent over space, and they often dominate the momentum and heat transport in the system. So the question is, what are those structures in the sun? How long do they live? Standing in the way. And do we have any hope of actually detecting them? And also another thing to come out of turbulence research is very often things are very sensitive to what happens in the boundary layers. They occupy a very small fraction of the domain, but they could have a huge influence on what goes on. So the granulation at the top and the tachocline at the bottom, how does that affect large-scale things?
Technical question about the anelastic approximation. Mm-hmm. The bottom boundary, are you going to be able to have a change in the stability of the mean? Is that possible to have the mean
penetration?
A mean atmosphere, right?
Right.
It can change its stability.
Right. We have done runs with a stable layer on the bottom, so that convection penetrates into the stable layer. The limitation there is the gravity wave time scale. In the sun, if you go too deep into the interior, periods of gravity waves are seconds or minutes.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to take small time steps to resolve those.
I just didn't even know if it wasn't ruled out by the anelastic.
Yeah, so how important are the boundary layers? And of course, as we touched upon, we want to know how these convective structures are influenced by rotation, stratification, magnetic fields, ionization, compressibility, radiative transfer, and all kinds of things, so we know how to apply them to other stars. And of course, when you add magnetic fields, there are tons more questions you can ask. The most compelling is, how does all this mess of turbulent fluctuations produce a large-scale cyclic magnetic field? And then you can also ask things which may have bearing on the large-scale dynamics of the magnetic field that Janet was talking about yesterday. So specifically for the differential rotation, though, there are three challenges from helioseismology. Nearly radial angular velocity contours at mid-latitudes, not cylindrical, which you would expect from Taylor-Proudman. Monotonic decrease in angular velocity from equator to pole of about 30%. Just for perspective, the early pioneering simulations of Gilman and Glatzmeyer 20 years ago, they got this wrong, that wrong. This one was okay. But 30% contrast from equator to pole they could do. But oh no, it's the right direction. It's pretty easy to spin up the equator, actually. Banana cells do that. Laminar convection does that.
Yeah, I think what you were saying earlier is even if there is the equator going faster, right at the pole, you expect to spin up just from the angle of conservation.
And a lot of the simulations, early ones and most of the ones we do now, show increase right near the pole, above about 70 degrees latitude. Things tend, a polar vortex is what Peter Gilman called it 20 years ago.
Totally excluded by the,
it's not totally excluded, but it seems unlikely. It's reasonably reliable data goes up to 60 or 70 degrees in latitude, and there's no hint of any kind of speed up.
In the Earth's atmosphere, we have strong pole.
Yeah, that's right.
Strangely enough, when we sort of watch the weather map when it moves down and so on, but we're afraid to talk about it.
Yeah, it may be possible, but again, we need a NBI type instrument above the solar pole to figure that out.
Confident that your theory is correct.
Well, as I showed you, most of our simulations do have a polar vortex, but there are a couple that don't and look more promising.
Can I ask, there's one more I was hoping you would put on there, which is, how does the core of the sun
Right.
Spin down and remain rigid. Is that not viewed as a challenge?
Well, I'm talking here about deep shell modeling. So I said it sort of at the beginning. There are different efforts. There's one effort aimed at the a deep convection zone. It should be the bulk of the convection zone. There's another effort aimed at the upper shear layer. There's another effort aimed at the tachocline. And the one most relevant to the interior rotation is the tachocline. And I'll get to that. I won't go in detail about the theories in the interior, but.
Now that you mentioned magnetic fields, and I was just wondering, I thought that it's believed that over the long term, the sun is spinning down by the action of the magnetic torque.
Right.
And how do we know that happens uniformly over the sun? So why is that not a consideration?
Yeah, that's a good question. Did everybody hear that? If spin down from the solar wind, is non-uniform, and although the magnetic field is very small, if it acts for a very long time scale, it might be able to.
Well, it's been acting for 5 years, and it's spun us down to 1.5 kilometers per second from 100 kilometers per second. So it's done a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right, so.
So Hank Sprout mentioned this sort of back of envelope calculation that you can do, which is if you had a 1 Gauss field, in the solar interior, which would be undetectable from a heliocentric model's point of view, that you get an Alphane transit time, which would be kind of like a spring constant, which is about, I think it was 10 to the 10 seconds, which is a few thousand years. So if you were to assume that those oscillations were to die out on a bunch of those periods, then you'd also have a quasi-static rigid rotation that's slowly increasing.
Yeah, my answer to that, though, is I think it's unlikely because there is convection any way you slice it. And the convection will want to redistribute angular momentum.
I'm talking about in
In the interior. Oh, yeah. This is a different question.
Yeah.
Your question was,
more
can it account for the differential rotation?
Yeah.
But probably not. To answer that question is there is convection and it does redistribute angular momentum on timescales of months and years. So if there was this very slow effect, the convection would dominate it. And then the other question is it gets back to the question about the interior. What keeps the interior uniform? And that's a very very small magnetic field that can do that.
Just one last comment on this question. I've thought of that before, so every time I go to Ulysses talk, I always ask them, so what is the mass loss rate as a function of latitude on the sun? Because the polar is faster, but it's less dense. It's not clear that the mass loss rate is strongly latitudinal dependent.
It is dense.
Right.
Density more or less uniformly distributed over the latitude.
No, the fast wind is less dense than the slow wind.
Yeah, but it comes from high regions.
The other
thing is, you don't know how deeply embedded those polar fields are, where they go to inside the sun. They attach to the core.
Let's move on. I haven't showed you any results yet. This is results from a recent paper by Sasha Brun and Yuri Tumre. It's similar things have been found in previous paper, but this nicely lays out the general trends. As you go down in this diagram, we're decreasing the dissipation in the system, so things become more turbulent, decreasing the viscosity and the thermal diffusivity. This is the radial velocity at the top, the middle, and the bottom of the convection zone. This is the temperature in the middle of the convection zone. And as you decrease the dissipation, no surprise, things become more complex and more intricate. Especially in the turbulent cases, the flow is dominated near the top. There's a intricate network of downflow lanes, which evolves on timescales of weeks and even days. And as you go down, it loses much of its connectivity, and things are dominated by intermittent strong plumes of downflow. And these patterns propagate them by themselves and are advected and sheared along by the differential rotation. So what type of differential rotation do these produce? We're going to look at two cases. We're going to look at this one, AB, and case D. And the main difference is D being much more turbulent and complex, and A being, and I should mention, even though our most laminar solutions are significantly more complex than the early stuff of Gilman and Glatzmeyer 20 years ago. So all of these are more turbulent than that. So what's the differential rotation look like in this guy and that guy? The top is the more laminar one. The bottom is the more turbulent one. And how does case AB do in our challenges? It gives about a 30% contrast in angular velocity. And it's one of the few cases where the angular velocity keeps decreasing with latitude. So we do get slow poles in this one. And at mid-latitudes, contours are reasonably radial. So this one is one of our best cases that looks pretty much like the sun. As you make the thing more turbulent, you get more cylindrical profiles, and the poles are starting to spin up. So this is a bit of a puzzle. You think, as I said, Reynolds numbers in the sun are something like 10 to the 12th. So as you go from a smaller Reynolds number to a larger Reynolds number, you'd expect the agreement to get better. It doesn't.
Mark, you don't expect monotonic dependence. You expect increase Reynolds number, and stuff becomes more and more chaotic. But the nature works out. At some point, it converts small-scale motions into viscosity and creates different patterns. So at some respect, you have to meet this transition going from molecular viscosity resonance to what axial to turbulent, and you have different structure and different things. It's a non-monotonic dependence.
Yeah, perhaps, but that's the easier way out, I think.
Where does it go?
Saying, okay, we'll cut it off here and say it's turbulent viscosity, so we have our answer.
It would be simple.
Mark is saying it's a brute force calculation, so
right.
We just have to go further and further.
Yeah, we don't want to. I mean,
at some point we'll be bifurcation.
Yeah, that's the hope, that eventually you'll get to a point where it doesn't depend on the Reynolds number. That viscosity and diffusivity will be so small that they don't play any role at all, and but we're not there yet. Another interesting part of this is to see how much of this is a thermal wind. So let's go to case AB, which is pretty solar-like, and we look at the cylindrical gradient. The gradient of the angular velocity along lines aligned with the rotation axis. And you see there are large variations from cylindrical rotation, Taylor-Proudman, near the bottom of the shell and near the top, where things get more radial. And then you can ask how much of that is a thermal wind. You can compute the entropy gradient with latitude and see how much of that is balanced by this cylindrical gradient. And this is what you get, and then you could subtract the two and see what's left. So the answer seems to be that the departures from Taylor-Proudman near the bottom of the shell are almost entirely in thermal wind balance. So these departures, these radial contours near the bottom, are driven by latitudinal entropy gradients, which are established by dependence of heat flux with latitude in the convection. I should also mention there's no cylindrical or no centrifugal force in these anelastic equations. So it's not a baroclinic effect of geopotentials being misaligned with entropy contours because of centrifugal effects. But near the top, there's a residual. This departure near the top is certainly not in thermal wind balance. And you can explain this with the picture I gave at the beginning, saying that near the top is where the vorticity becomes very large, so your Rossby number is not necessarily small anymore, so you don't expect thermal wind balance. If you look at the structures near the top, as I said, they evolve on timescales of days and weeks. The rotation rate is a month, so they're rotationally influenced, but not in the in the strongly rotating limit.
How many rotation rates in your limits
were? These are, let's see, this one has been run for something like 80, I think.
Are you asking how many different rates or how many rotations?
No, just as how long is, I mean, this is the...
Something like 80 rotation periods.
You see things as you're running it, like baroclinic instabilities because of all, and you've got a lot of baroclinicity because of your...
Right.
Do you run it for long enough to find all those instabilities, do you think?
I don't know what the time scale is, actually, for baroclinic instabilities. And no, we don't see anything that looks like that.
I mean, this is terminally unstable.
Perfect.
The whole thing is terminally unstable. I mean, baroclinic instability you have in a stable stratified layer, but there is baroclinic, so the horizontal motions can get unstable. But here, the vertical motions are already unstable.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, density and entropy variations are maintained by the convection.
Well,
so,
yeah, fine. Okay.
It's a little bit unclear how a baroclinic instability would proceed.
In fact, the thermal wind contribution that must mean that the effectiveness of the convective transport is also a function of volume.
Right.
So, do you understand why that is?
Well, you can think of it if you have a shell that's rotating, and you turn up the rotation, you can shut off the convection, and that happens first at the poles. That basically Coriolis forces will tend to. At low latitudes. Can you see this? At low latitudes, you can have convection cells which align with the rotation axis. And if you're very rapidly rotating, they can still get heat out. But at high latitudes, overturning motions are inhibited by rotation. So as you increase the rotation rate, you'll tend to, these modes will tend to stay, and these modes you'll tend to get rid of. So then you'll get a big heat flux out here, but very little at high latitudes.
So you get a bigger temperature gradient, you get a higher temperature.
Right.
How big can you make
that? Well, we're constrained by the rotation rate of the sun.
Well, but in rapidly rotating stars, you see polar spots all the time. Every single one of them has a very strong polar spot. And people have assumed that, well, okay, if you have magnetic flux emerging from the face of the convection zone, Coriolis force takes that magnetic flux towards the pole, so you might get a concentration of magnetic field at the pole. But if you can just cool it down by inhibiting convection, maybe you don't need to rely on the flux emergence.
Yeah, like I said, if you take it all the way, if you rotate it fast enough, any convection can be shut off. It depends on the Rossby number of convection.
Can I get a 1,000 degree difference?
I haven't. Yeah, sure. Yeah, in the laminar cases that Peter Gilman was running, the banana cell type cases that are only slightly above critical, you get 30 to 50% variations in the heat flux coming out of latitude. And that was viewed as a drawback or problem with the early simulations. But
stars are just like that.
Yeah.
In a simple term, we have thermal winds up to say 30 degrees. When Coriolis force become large, we have cylinders, Taylor-Proudman condition. That's your best case.
Well, thermal wind at the bottom, yes,
yeah.
But at the top, not cylinders. No, at the top, it's not cylindrical. You still have gradients.
Oh, you
but it's just not thermal wind.
Radial defects.
Yeah, you still have gradients, so you still have non-cylindrical profiles near the top, but it's not a thermal wind balance. It's Reynolds stresses that are doing it.
Do you have a problem with regular circulation?
Not handy. I have the paper here. Uh, And I should just mention that typically the ones, the cases with the, yeah, you can see this. This is cases A, B, and case B. The next page shows streamlines, which are a little. I was going to mention that the cases which generally show the most solar-like differential rotation profiles also show the most solar-like meridional circulation. So this one has a more solar-like circulation with poleward flow near the top.
Do you have any idea what happens as you run the simulation longer? I mean, the concern would be, the question is, do you need to run much longer in the high-resolution cases?
The high-resolution cases are usually run for tens of rotation periods, not hundreds.
So the question is, have you monitored?
That's
evolution in that.
As well as we can.
You mean
I mean, we're not going to.
The system will fall to capacity
settlement.
You know, they're pretty. If you look at angular momentum fluxes and you sum up meridional circulation plus Reynolds stress component plus diffusion component in these, most of them balance out, suggesting it's not.
I mean, there's a different time scale coming in, the thermal time scale, because the entropy gradient, the entropy follows it, is determined by the Healy gradient.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a very long time scale here. And as you go up in resolution, you may not be able to capture that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's.
So the entropy gradient, which you are hoping to get, of course, doesn't have a chance to build up yet.
So what he's saying, you might have two or three maybe different stationary particles. You
right.
Show that's us. But if you change the parameter space, you may default to another pattern.
And that's certainly what we've been doing. Sasha and Julian Elliott before him have just been trying a lot of parameters and trying different initial conditions and see if you can get different basins of attraction and get different types of flows. Have we become yellow all of a sudden?
That's okay. We like it. Go on, don't worry.
Anyway, let me just. And this is sort of a summary of some results from Brun and Trumer. So you have two types of dissipation in the system. You have a viscosity and you have a thermal diffusivity. And when you lower the dissipation to make the thing more turbulent, you can do it by either, what you want to do is lower the viscosity, and you can do it in two ways. You can lower the diffusivity with it so that you keep the Prandtl number constant, or you can keep the diffusivity the same and just lower the viscosity. So you'd lower the Prandtl number too. And the original simulations by Julian Elliott and myself took the first path. Whenever we decreased the viscosity, we also decreased the diffusivity to leave the Prandtl number constant. And we were finding that you lost your differential rotation. These are different A, B, B, and D are becoming more turbulent, decreasing the viscosity and diffusivity together, and you're losing your differential rotation contrast. And all of these stay about 30%, which is like the sun, but in some of the earlier ones, they were down to 10% or 15% non-solar-like. But a recent result is that if you keep the thermal diffusivity constant and just decrease the viscosity, that's A to B to C, then you can keep big differential rotation contrast even in more turbulent simulations.
Good explanation. Would the turbulent diffusivities, I would have thought the Prandtl number would be close to 1.
Well, it depends whether you think it may be less than 1 because of the differences in momentum transport, which is a vector quantity, and temperature transport, which is a scalar quantity. So you might expect it to be like 1/3.
Okay.
But somewhere between
decreasing the viscosity,
then he'll go back.
So there's an argument for a Prandtl number of 1. There's also an argument that says
quibble over 10^-4 or something.
Well, no, I was also going to say that in a turbulent fluid, basically how transport occurs, how turbulent transport occurs, it builds up big gradients in whatever you have. And there's another view that your turbulent viscosity is going to be, and diffusivity or turbulent Prandtl number is going to be similar to your molecular Prandtl number. And in that case, if that's true, the molecular Prandtl number in the sun is very tiny. So if you take that view.
Why you lose the differential rotation if you decrease the thermal diffusivity as you decrease the viscosity?
Take it from the other point. Why does if you just decrease the viscosity, why do you increase the differential rotation contrast? And the answer seems to be there. As you decrease the viscous dissipation, there's just more kinetic energy in the convection. And the convection does tend to...
There could be more kinetic energy in the convection if you also decrease the thermal diffusivity. So that's not the answer.
But this line here, no, it's not well understood. I can't explain why it depends so much on the Prandtl number. But I'll just summarize these results and then let people go. I've already taken enough time, and I'm just on the deep shell stuff. But summary of the deep shell stuff, where we stand, we're approaching consistency with helioseismic data, definite improvement over the Gilman and Glassmeyer stuff 20 years ago.
Except that you said that you get better results for the less turbulent case. And you're saying this, but your improvement over them is because they were longer.
Yeah. But the most turbulent cases generally don't get the best agreement with helioseismic conversions. So there is a puzzle there. That we're still looking for highly turbulent cases that give good comparison with helioseismic results. Thermal wind is important, at least near the lower convection zone, but it's not the whole story. In the upper convection zone, departures from Taylor-Proudhon are not in thermal wind balance. And as always, as we've been saying for some time, in stratified convection, you have a rapidly evolving downflow lanes, network of downflow lanes near the top, which disintegrates into strong plumes near the bottom. And we're still not in the low dissipation limit, which applies to the sun. Results are sensitive to Reynolds and Prandtl's numbers and things of this sort. So there's more work to do. And now I can say that anybody can leave. I can talk about results modeling the upper shear layer and the tachocline, but I've already gone long enough. So please feel free to leave if you choose. And actually, would you mind getting me some water, or if you're going?
Sure.
Can I just one time?
Yeah.
What is the ratio of your Reynolds stress to your pressure?
To the pressure, they're comparable.
So the pressure of the fluid is comparable to the Reynolds stress? That's
pressure
driving the differential rotation? Is that possible?
I mean, you mean pressure work, or?
The P of the gas.
Right. Generally,
otherwise you'd start subsonic computing. Spinning up the star like crazy. So it must be very tiny. Yeah, that would be supersonic.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very tiny.
What's
the Reynolds stress divided by the pressure?
So yeah.
It would be subsonic if your velocities, the energy, your kinetic energy approaches the internal energy. But your grad P, generally in Boussinesq systems too, your grad P is typically comparable to your V dot grad V. It's true that it's subsonic, so your internal energy P over gamma minus one is much less than rho V squared, but the magnitude of your pressure gradients is of order V squared over L. It's of order your V dot grad V term.
It's correlating VR and V5, and that's not the same as V squared.
And it's what?
Well, I'm just saying, yeah. It's comparable to your V dot grad V term. That that this is typically true in turbulence. If you have
well, so it has to be that.
Yeah.
If you're not having large fluctuations in velocity or viscous effects, those are the only two terms that can balance in the equation.
Right.
No, no, I understand he's saying that the angular momentum of balanced by the change in the
gravity,
of course.
Oh, the reason the reason pressure doesn't come into the angular momentum balance.
No, no, I'm just wondering how big this stress is.
This is only made horizontal, yeah.
So, like, I know what the pressure of the star is, say. Uh-huh. I want to know how big the stress is compared to the fiducial stress, which is the pressure.
Oh, it's a good question, because this is generally true. Pressure gradients are comparable to V dot grad V, but as the flow becomes more turbulent, correlations tend to decrease.
Okay. So you're saying that VR, VY in the turbulent case can be much, much smaller than P.
Yes.
Right. So
the Reynolds stresses, yeah.
So I just like to make a point that since your argument for neglecting the magnetic field is that B squared is much, much smaller than P. Mm-hmm. But that does not necessarily mean that VR V phi is much, much smaller than VR V phi. If you correlate VR and V phi, it doesn't mean it's much, much bigger than the correlator of VR and V phi. And if you have a magnetic field, your original equation is that, you know, it basically is just a statement of conservation of angular momentum is no longer true, because the conserved current or quantity is not no longer angular momentum, but the combination of angular momentum and magnetic flux.
Right.
So even if the magnetic field is very small, it could have an enormous contribution to this small transport layer.
But again, if the large scale magnetic field,
it doesn't matter. I mean, you're saying that VRV5, the correlator of VRV5, is much, much smaller than P. So the quantity to, you can't really.
It could be. I mean. As we increase the turbulence level in our simulations, the correlation goes down. It's certainly not as small as the beta of the plasma.
Is huge down below.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the point that's being made is that you don't need a large scale field.
It's possible.
Correlation.
Yeah.
You need correlation.
Right.
That's different than comparing V squared and P. And not only that, just, you know, your original symmetry that you're evolving all your equations is actually not completely correct.
What do you mean?
Well, if, you know, so this is all basically coming from, you know, everything is, so he's saying angular momentum is conserved, right? Which he's really saying circulation is conserved. In this case, since V is only in the phi direction, that's circulation. Circulation angular momentum is conserved, right? Mm-hmm. Not the Z axis. So, if you have a magnetic field in the ploidal direction,
yeah,
the conserved quantity is no longer circulation, but a combination of circulation and magnetic flux.
But the magnetic field is all tangled too.
That's fine. I'm just saying, you know, if you have some net ploidal flux and a fluid rotating, you know, in the phi direction, mm-hmm. the first equation he wrote is no longer correct.
Well, just if you include Lorentz forces.
Especially
this.
If you're looking at turbulence.
I mean, don't we know from turbulence that the magnetic field rapidly grows to the partition of the small scale field rapidly grows to the partition of the small scale field?
No, we certainly don't know that.
There's no partition of small scale.
The magnetic energy, if you talk to Fausto, he says the magnetic energy is equal to the kinetic energy divided by the magnetic Reynolds number. And see if the magnetic Reynolds number is big.
Please stretch our legs and ready to
yeah.
Come behind you.
There's lots more to talk about. If people want to leave, feel free.
You want to talk about all this other stuff? That's why we're sitting here.
Let's see. No, what was the question? You were saying that.
Yeah, so you're saying divergence. So this is, you know.
Yeah. So if you, yeah, right. If you include Lorentz forces. Yeah. If you include Lorentz forces, then yeah, you'll get a different equation.
In the equilibrium, you would say, okay, it doesn't matter because B is so small. But if you're taking correlations of turbulent flows, neglecting it, it could be very.
But I mean, the argument is that it's secondary. I mean, we know from the calculations, and also from some other model calculations that have been done with magnetic fields, that the effect of the magnetic field is on the few percent level and explains, and is consistent with what is observed. It gives you the
torsional oscillations,
for example. And the CVSS model, you can also observe deeper down, of course, the variations, and we're also seeing variations. So they're definitely there, but they're on the few percent level. So they are not primary to the cause of differential rotation.
But that's for the large scale field. But if there is a small scale field produced by dynamo, that may not be cycle independent.
So basically what I was saying here, like Bob said, that in the meridional component of this equation, grad P, if you have a steady state, grad P has to be comparable to this term.
In horizontal directions.
In horizontal, yeah. In vertical, you also have this. But
we're interested in transport of angular momentum, you know, which is going to end up producing motions along.
Right, you have correlations.
So these are very, the transport is very tiny. You know, it's not humongous. It's not like the background in terms of energy. It's
well, it's tiny. You have to put 30% from a greater to column.
It takes
tiny. It's a huge transport.
Yeah, it takes 10 rotation periods or so to spin up.
Yeah, but the kinetic energy in the rotation of the star, I'm pretty sure it's much, much smaller than the pressure.
Yeah.
So it's still tiny compared to the
magnetic pressure. Is
it's still
smaller.
Tiny. And
that's just saying it's subsonic.
The original comparison is B squared to P. Okay, so so I'm asking, what is being compared?
Well, magnetic pressure isn't going to make any difference, because when you average it over longitude, you'll have a d by d phi of b squared, which averages out in longitude. So the only thing that would affect this is magnetic tension.
Stress, the
RPM. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. And I'm saying, is it comparable in this turbulence with VRP?
It could be. I mean, yeah, we get things that look somewhat solar-like without any magnetic fields, but they might. All right, so I guess we'll go on. This is just going on. So we talked about the bulk of the convection zone. Now, there's another modeling effort which is concerned with the shear layer near the top of the convection zone. So just below the photosphere, you see this negative angular velocity gradient that I can show you. Well, basically, the angular velocity increases with radius through most of the convection zone and then suddenly drops off. And what's going on there? And also, what happens with the meridional circulation? Does the circulation within the convection zone just imprint itself through the shear layer and you see it on the surface? Or is there some secondary circulation, very thin cells, which is set up in this shear layer? What role do supergranules play? What other scales of motion might be present? And again, can we detect them? How does this layer couple to the deep convection zone, and what role does it play in the dynamo? There's some suggestion that this supergranulation layer near the surface is where the poloidal field regeneration occurs, or as in Nick Brommel's talk, whether you want to call it the turbulent alpha effect or call it something else, you need something to regenerate poloidal field from toroidal field. But we're considering non-magnetic for the time being. So this is a simulation. So Mark DeRosa led this effort. And the idea was just to take the ASH code, the same convection code, and just do it in a very thin shell. The bottom of the shell is 0.9 R sun, top is 0.98 R sun. For comparison, our other deep shell calculations typically went up to 0.96 R sun. So this is a thin layer near the top. Some of them were from 0.9 to 0.98, some of them were 0.94 to 0.98. These are the deeper shell ones.
15 millimeters below the surface, and the bottom is 70.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
Periodicity
here?
I mean, how much?
Oh, yeah. He imposed a fourfold periodicity and longitude to reduce the computational expense a bit. What's that?
Everything
yeah, everything in theta, fourfold periodicity and longitude.
It's still thicker than observed.
Oh, yeah.
Drop.
Yeah. All right, it's thicker. The upper shear layer is about 5% of the sun.
And that's important.
Well, perhaps. Like I said, he did another simulation from 0.94 our sun to 0.98, and the results are similar to this one.
If you did the opposite sort of thing, if you went to the very top, then everybody would say it's totally unimportant because the Coriolis force is so small compared to.
Yeah, and the anelastic approximation would break down too.
Must be somehow the right thing that you're doing here.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's very interesting what the results are. Near the top, you see a network of large downflow lanes, which is about 200 megameters across. But also within these downflow lanes, you see these bright spots. You see other structure that's on the scale of supergranules. These are about 20 megameters across. And these things are advected along by the larger scale flow pattern. So you see these little supergranules advected by the larger flow and sucked up into the downflow lanes. Yeah, these are bigger scales. They're not observed in the sun.
The full size of the convection zone, they're in between.
Right.
Expect to see all the scales. I mean, this is exactly what you expect to see.
And these might be influenced by the depth of the shell, too. So I wouldn't put too much faith in these. I wouldn't put design an experiment to look for them on the sun. But
you see that size, the large size that you see is because of the depth you've taken for your shell. But the basic structure is important.
Perhaps. These 200 megameter across are about the same for the shell that's 8% thick and 4% thick. They're not just a simple multiple of your depth, but they are probably influenced by the thin shell.
It's a question of where did you take the 4% from the bottom, from the same bottom or the same top?
Same top.
They're not multiple because you get number pi. If you take radial convection.
Well, what I'm saying is they don't vary at all. 0.94 to 0.98 is the same size network as 0.9 to 0.98. So it's not this isn't the size of the box, or the depth of the box.
But what about the gradient?
The gradient, yeah, I'll get to that.
Okay.
So again, this shows very nicely that there's a complicated network of connected downflows near the top, and as you get down, you still keep sort of the large scales, outlines of the convection of the network at the top, but it's dominated now by strong isolated downward plumes. So what is the differential rotation? We can watch a movie of these things being advected around. Where's it going? Yeah, so you see lots of... You see these small bright spots being advected both by the differential rotation and by the larger scale flow pattern. So they move across these bigger cells into the and are sucked up by the downflow lanes. Well, that's influenced by the fourfold periodicity. When you do a fourfold periodicity in longitude, funny things happen at the poles. So don't